This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, WMUK's Erlene McMichael talks to Kalamazoo College student Cammie Simmons about her Reader's Theater play, inspired by the life of the late African-American radio pioneer Hal Jackson. But first, in his most recent book, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar writes that if he had been a foot shorter, he might have had a career as a high school history teacher instead of being remembered as a basketball legend. Writings on the Wall, Searching for a New Equality Beyond Black and White, is this year's selection for the Kalamazoo Public Library's Reading Together program. Author Kareem Abdul-Jabbar will appear at Miller Auditorium on Tuesday. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, nice to be with you.
So tell us what that title means, Writings on the Wall.
I think it was just certain things that to me appeared to be very obvious, like writings on a big wall, you know, like graffiti, something that we need to pay attention to, and I wanted to call attention to it.
There's a lot of subjects you get to in this book, but in the introduction, you confront the question that you think might be on some readers' minds. Why should I be listening to what a former basketball player has to say about issues like race, gender, the media? And first of all, if you could maybe give your response to that, but I'm also wondering if sometimes you think that maybe the substance of what you have to say might get muted by the fact that you're a celebrity seen for other things.
Well, I would just have to say that I have had the opportunity to travel the world and know and meet a lot of people, and I've seen some things, and I'm a concerned American, and I felt I should use my voice to speak out on something that I know is a serious issue for my country.
And do you think that maybe sometimes people don't get the full message of what you're saying because they do see you as the guy who played for the Lakers, et cetera?
Well, yeah, I could see that people would not be interested in what I might have to say because it's coming from someone who was an athlete. On the other hand, there are people who, because of my status as a famous athlete, might be interested in what I had to say just out of curiosity. So I'm confident and to take my chances and see how people respond. And so far, it's been a good response.
You have some experience as a journalist. You've written for Time. You've written for The Washington Post. You're undertaking a new endeavor with The Hollywood Reporter. But you also, as you write in this book, have been on that other side of it. You've been in the media spotlight. Of course, you know, people were interviewing you and covering you with when you were a basketball player, et cetera. So having been on both sides of that divide, what sort of perspective do you think that brings?
Well, I think it gives me an opportunity to speak knowingly about subjects that have to do with life on either side of that divide. So, you know, I have a great perspective because I can say that I've been there and I've done it to either side of that equation.
Some athletes choose to speak out publicly on social issues. Some do not. How do you view that? Do you think it's a responsibility of athletes to take a stance on important issues to the community, to the fans who follow their games?
Well, I think that the athletes who go through the trouble to be knowledgeable, they have a right to speak their voice. And if they have the ability to do it in a convincing way, then you know, more power to them. Everybody has to use their platform as they see fit. And the fact that you are able to be successful in a field like athletics gives you a great public platform, and a lot of attention is focused on you at various times. And a lot of people use that opportunity in their minds to do good. And, you know, that's how I see it. I think I'm fortunate to have the opportunity to speak out on issues that concern me and that are definitely a focal point on what's going on in our country.
On the subject of race, you write that you experienced racism at a very young age and you expect to face it until you die. But in the paragraph before that, you also say that it is perfectly understandable why so many white people believe that there is no racism, the most important being that they are not personally racist. So do we have a situation where it's a lot of problems caused by a few people? Or are the people who don't recognize racism not recognizing systemic problems that do exist?
I think they don't recognize systemic problems that do exist. It's hard for them to see the problem. It doesn't affect them. So that's a problem for the people who are affected negatively by it to convey what the issues are, you know, the pain and problem that comes with these issues. Being of a different race in white America can be a very painful and negative experience. But, you know, you can't expect white people to understand that when they've never experienced it. So we have to go the extra mile to communicate that. But that's the way the chips fall. That's our burden. And for people who have issues, they have to convey their concerns and what the issues are in a way that people can understand it, enabling people to move forward.
You describe some of your own evolution when it comes to thoughts on gender. You say that if you could go back and talk to that young Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, you'd set him straight on a few things. Does that maybe inform the way that you try to talk to people about issues such as race and religion, where perhaps you recognize that they do need to be enlightened?
Yeah, I can see where they need to be enlightened. And because of my experience, I can see where the blinders are for some people, the things that are keeping them from having an understanding. And, you know, having that insight, I can point things out and enable them to, you know, see the other side. Because that's all this needs to be, is, you know, for good people to see the other guy's argument and understand his perspective, you know, in order to, you know, make a change that benefits everybody. Police officers don't want to be seen as villains and bad guys. Yet what you've seen on film now of black Americans being shot for no good reason, it's disturbing. It disturbs everybody. Doesn't matter what color you are. You see that and you don't like it and you want to be able to change it. So, you know, we've made some progress. We have ways to go, though.
You also bring a little different perspective to that issue, the relations between minority communities and the police, because your father was a police officer.
Yeah. I know what it's like, you know, to be a kid and wondering, is your dad coming home? You know, that can be a serious concern. And we want all the guys in blue to come home safe every night. They're awesome. The job they do is absolutely essential. So, you know, we got to give them the support they need. But we also have to, you know, get it so that they don't continue to do things that disturb us. Like what I mentioned, seeing people being shot and killed for no good reason.
You also say in your book that you are on the media's speed dial of celebrity Muslims who end up going on television every time there's a terrorist attack. Is there a better way to cover this, or do we still need to hear from people like you when there's an attack to explain that, no, this is really not part of the religion that you subscribe to?
I think so. Every now and then, I think some people need to be reminded. You know, but other people, you know, they get it. The analogy I used had to do with, you know, the Christians use the Ku Klux Klan as an example of Christianity. Of course not. These people, ISIS and people like that, they're the equivalent of the Ku Klux Klan in Islamic culture. They are people who have gone and just embraced murder and mayhem because people don't want to subscribe to how they see things. You know, it's fascism. It's not Islam. And, you know, we have to remind people of that. But, you know, again, that's our burden. And, you know, hopefully people will listen.
You write about voter suppression in this book, and you say that the interests of people who are poor are really not represented because of the lower turnout for people on the lower end of the income scale. But you also say that people who don't want to vote should not be encouraged to do so. So it kind of explained what you would do when it comes to voting laws if it were just up to you.
Our Constitution says one person, one vote. You know, just give everybody the opportunity to vote. But, you know, if people don't want to inform themselves and understand what the issues are, their votes really kind of are superfluous. An informed electorate is the best kind, and I think that's something that we should all encourage.
And on the subject of an informed vote, you express some pretty strong opinions in this book on a wide array of issues. But you also tell us several times that we shouldn't be reluctant to listen to arguments that we don't agree with, to engage the other side. I'm wondering if there's an issue. We mentioned your evolution before on women's issues. I'm wondering if there are other ones where maybe taking in new information or having an argument framed in another way made you reconsider and change, or maybe at least shift your stance on a certain issue?
Those things happen to me continually. You know, as you get older and survive so many of life's slings and arrows, as they say, you know, you get some wisdom and some perspective that enables you to change for the better, I hope. And I hope that's what's happened in my case.
And you write about aging in this book as well, and as in some ways it is a relief, and you say there's a lot of things that are very enjoyable as you near your 70th birthday, but you do have concerns for the elderly population in this country. Kind of spell them out for us.
Well, I think that the elderly population really gets overlooked. There's a lot of wisdom there, and certainly there's a lot of thought that needs to be injected into the current discourse of our country, the political discourse. So, you know, you can't just ignore all that wisdom and ability to contribute because people are seen as useless once they get to be 55 or 60 years old. That's crazy. And I hope we continue to move away from that thought.
I mentioned at the beginning that you had a deep interest in history at a young age and thought that maybe at one time you might be interested in being a history teacher. As you say, if you were a foot shorter, maybe that's what you would have done. But as you say in this book, if you were a high school history teacher, you might still be working right now, wondering if you could afford to retire. How concerned are you about just the overall status of the American dream?
I think that it's in danger. Our educational system is not serving the majority of the people that they're supposed to serve. So, we've got to do a better job of making it possible for people to be educated and contribute to society. I think that should be a key focus for all of our politicians and educators.
So as a sports fan, I've got to ask you about something you wrote here towards the end about, you say that you expect that all of your records will be broken eventually. But you still hold the record for most points in an NBA career, and you've been retired now for over 25 years. Does that surprise you, especially considering that players like Michael Jordan had an opportunity to play after you had stepped aside?
It's very, very difficult to keep playing and playing when you're getting paid like $20 and $30 million a year. You know, the guys get to be 35 and say, hey, now it's time to find that island and the cool drink. You know, so I think that more than anything gives my record a chance of enduring, but you never know.
In other words, the way the salaries kind of shot up after you retired maybe pads people's bank accounts a bit that they can retire earlier than you did?
Yeah, you know, LeBron doesn't need to keep playing, you know, and he's done it all. He's won his championship and done everything to satisfy his professional ambition, and then he's got all this huge bankroll. I think maybe he's going to need that time to count some more of those dollars.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, thank you very much for your time.
It was a pleasure talking to you, and I hope to see you on Tuesday.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's most recent book, Writings on the Wall, Searching for a New Equality Beyond Black and White, is this year's selection for the Kalamazoo Public Library's Reading Together program. A link with details about Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's appearance on Tuesday at Miller Auditorium can be found at WMUK.org.
This is West Southwest on WMUK. I'm Earlene McMichael. Kalamazoo College senior Cami Simmons on Saturday presents a reader's theater play inspired by the life of African-American radio pioneer Hal Jackson. She met Mr. Jackson when she was in high school, but didn't know his important role in history. In fact, so important that when he died in 2012 at age 96, it was a news story in the New York Times. Jackson was the first African-American to be inducted into the National Association of Broadcasters Hall of Fame in 1990. He has also been inducted into the National Radio Hall of Fame. He not only was a radio personality, but radio station owner. Be advised that this interview contains strong language involving race. Every student at Kalamazoo College has to do a senior individualized project. In a nutshell, what is that?
So basically, a senior individualized project is something that you do as a capstone for your senior year. So basically, you choose a project, whether it's a research paper, or for me, in my case, it was a playwriting project that I did through the theater arts department, and you do it for your whole semester. And so it's your last big, like, capstone before you graduate.
And we'll talk more in detail about who Hal Jackson is later, but walk us through how you decided to focus on his achievements and his life as your particular senior individualized project.
Sure. So I'm a theater arts major in a media studies concentration, and I had a large interest in theater. And so when coming to Kalamazoo College, I was very involved in theater, very involved in a lot of classes around theater. And so sophomore year in the summer, I did an internship with iHeartRadio because I didn't get the fellowship that I had applied to for theater. And so I thought to try out radio. And so I did this internship. And basically, after that, I started doing a little bit more research on Hal Jackson because I did a program with his daughter, Jane Harley, inside of D.C. And I wanted to learn more about him because I had did this program when I was younger, didn't really know who he was because I was young at the time. And so I did more research along the way. And I had brought up to my supervisor, which are senior individualized project, you get an advisor. And I had already knew who I wanted mine to be senior year, Ed Minta, who was the department chair of theater at the time, and he still worked at Kalamazoo College. But I had brought up to him that I wanted to find a way to bring together my interests of theater and now broadcasting and television together. And so I thought that this would be a great opportunity. I had started the basis of my research my junior year. And then when senior hit, I told him it would be a good idea if I can do a play on Hal Jackson because I recently took a playwriting class with Ed.
I should say at this point, you mentioned being in a program with his daughter, Hal Jackson's daughter, Jane Harley. It was an extracurricular weekend acting program.
Yeah.
You were in high school at the time. You did meet briefly Hal Jackson at that time, and that was pretty much the one and only time you did meet him.
Right.
Is that correct?
It was only like brief interactions with him. And like I said, I was there for a program. I knew that he was involved in entertainment, but I didn't know how much of a significance it was.
Okay, so now you're making your senior individualized project into a reader's theater play, inspired by the life, I should say, of Hal Jackson. You took a little creative license with it, but it really is essentially based on his life. It's called The Time Is Now. Tell us, what can people expect to see when they come on March 11th?
I have 21 characters, and basically the main character is Willie Earle, who is inspired by Hal Jackson, as well as some other people that I interviewed this past summer, because I did interview some of his previous interns, as well as one of his talented teens, who was a part of the Hal Jackson talented teens, and his daughter, Jane Harley.
Hal Jackson did so many things, and we'll talk more about that, but one of them was actually a beauty pageant for African-American teenagers. Continue.
The main character is Willie Earle, and also the main character is Deanna, who is inspired by his wife. But basically, the play just goes throughout his life. It starts out when he's a child and the relationship between him and his mom. And so it shows how, basically, Hal has this whole perspective of life that, you know, it's important to, it's nice to be important, but it's also important to be nice. And that was one of the quotes and one of the models that Hal Jackson lived by. It starts off with him and his mom and how he got to where he is at the end, which he becomes this big personality in radio and broadcasting, but he's also very humble about it. And he also helps people throughout the Black community. So his main goal isn't to be famous, but to also talk about these social issues through the medium of radio. It's definitely a work in progress. This is the beginning of me doing the play. I'm going to be changing it. Who knows? We'll see what happens. So.
Hal Jackson died in 2012 at the age of 96, so he had a long life. But before he actually left us, he actually wrote an autobiography about himself, The House That Jack Built, My mm-hmm. Life Story as a Trailblazer in Broadcasting and Entertainment. I believe you indicated offline that it was released in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
Just to show the significance of Hal Jackson, he actually had an obituary, a very long one, written, I should say really a news story, honestly, in the New York Times when he passed. In terms of your play and your research, can you indicate just some of your source material?
The majority of the facts that I looked at, I did read a couple articles that people wrote about Hal Jackson when he passed away, because the majority of the articles were written when he passed away. I also listened to a variety of interviews. The majority of them were on various radio stations when he was alive. And then his autobiography, which you mentioned, The House That Jack Built. So, and then also interviews.
You've interviewed Jane Harley.
It was just through, like, interactions.
With her when you were younger.
Exactly, when I was younger. And also when I mentioned to her about the project, I wanted to know a little bit more about Hal Jackson, her relationship with her father. And then I also interviewed a couple people who still work at WBLS, which is the station that's
in
now
New York
in
City.
New York.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then, like I said, the talented teen, Kim Swain, who's going to be one of the people who's coming up.
Are you indicating that you've interviewed folks that are still there now?
Mm. Two of them are still full-time at WBLS. One was an intern. She's a freelancer who goes from different stations. And then the talented teen, and she's also a freelancer, but she's still involved with radio, but more so television and music as well.
In terms of the recognitions that were bestowed upon Hal Jackson, he was the first African-American inducted into the National Association of Broadcasters Hall of Fame in 1990. And he was also among the first five African-Americans inducted into the Radio Hall of Fame in 1995. Tell us some more firsts in regards to, or just important things that Hal Jackson did.
Sure. So he was also one of the owners of the Washington Bears, which was the baseball team in Washington, D.C., he was also inducted into other broadcast-related organizations. But I would say he was also one of the first, in general, on radio who had a show which was originally entitled The Bronze Review, where he had a conversation with not only activists, but also musicians, politicians, and other people to talk about these issues within the Black community.
He grew up in Charleston, South Carolina. Then he went on to Washington, D.C. You indicate in some materials you gave me, he was in and around age 15 or so when he came to Washington, mm-hmm. D.C. I don't know if that's about right, but he kind of launched his radio career at that time. You mentioned earlier about a show, kind of an entertainment type show called The Bronze Review. And the story behind that, I think that you kind of uncovered and shared with me offline in terms of how that show came about, that he pitched an idea for that particular show mm-hmm. to the director of the radio station at the time. And this is a direct quote, apparently, right out of his autobiography in terms of what that response was. What was that?
So basically, the response was, no nigger would ever be on my radio station.
But he decided to circumvent the process by actually buying airtime on the radio station through a white wholesale buyer of airtime, I think is how you mm-hmm. indicated it. And somehow he managed to get on the show, to get on the air without revealing that he was involved in it. And all of a sudden that show was on the air. He went on from there, finding lots of ways to kind of make things happen
right.
For people of color. And ultimately, along the way, he made his way to New York City. And not only just to be, my understanding is, the first disc jockey on a radio station that was reaching a largely white audience. That was kind of the first time really that really started to happen. And he was a force on New York City radio for like more than 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about some of the significant things in terms of what he did in New York. He became a radio executive.
So he owned a plethora of radio stations, not only in D.C., but also in New York. There were some stations all over the country. He was also one of the owners of the Apollo Theater in New York for quite some time. And so he was just he was well known within the media broadcasting industry, but also the entertainment industry.
One of the things I found interesting in the material that you shared with me ahead of time is that in many of these radio stations where there were issues in him getting on the air or whatever it was, that he just ended up buying them.
Right. And he was very strategic when he bought him. I mean, when he first bought his first radio station, he did it through a white wholesaler, which I thought was pretty strategic. You know, he just didn't stop at someone just telling him no, but he found other ways to make it happen for himself.
And he also helped raise funds for different kinds of organizations, such as?
There was a lot of organizations. One in particular was for a hospital. I think it was an organization with kids where basically he had people donate books or donate different toys for.
Yeah, I think he started something called the Good Deed Club. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he started something called the Good Deed Club. He also, based on the materials you gave me, he raised funds for the National Association for the Advancements of Colored People, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and things like that. A lot of Black organizations were beneficiaries of some of his fundraising efforts.
Right.
Yeah. What else should we know about Hal Jackson?
I was surprised to learn how many people, even now, who are in the entertainment industry, were affected by him, such as Wendy Williams, which I was very surprised. She started at WBLS when Hal Jackson was still working there. And so that was a person.
And then she segued to having a national talk show.
I was very surprised, just the people who were very impacted by him. So Vanessa Williams was one of his talented teens, or Jada Pinkett Smith was one of his talented teens. I was just very surprised by how many people, to see where they were, where they started, like through programs like this, to where they are now. So that was one of the main things that I was very surprised about. And also just like how many things Hal Jackson did. He wasn't just involved in radio, but he was very involved in the community. He was very involved in philanthropy, and he just didn't limit himself.
I think some of your peers, you said, weren't aware of him.
Right.
As you say, I think the word you use is lost narratives,
mm-hmm.
that you feel passionate about bringing lost narratives forward.
Right. Yeah. A lot of people do not know about him. Even people who are my mom's age, anytime I brought up Hal Jackson, they would say, "Hal who?" And I was very, you know, surprised to hear how many people didn't know about him, especially with the influence that he's had through this play and through my research. I just hope that not only people you know, learn how to make it happen, as I would put it, because Hal Jackson did make it happen for himself. But I wanted this to be my gift to Kalamazoo College, in a way, to educate students on my campus who don't know about him, to educate people off of Kalamazoo College's campus about him, but to also be inspired through his stories.
And I guess as we sign off here, I should say that you did mention to one of his daughters, Jane Harley, the one with whom you have a relationship, that you were going to make this your project. Well, it's not like she's officially endorsing it, but you did certainly inform her that you were working on this as a project. Thank you, Cami, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Cami Simmons presents her Readers Theater Project about the life of African-American radio pioneer Hal Jackson at 3 p.m. Saturday, March 11th at the Light Fine Arts Building at Kalamazoo College. It'll be followed by a talkback and reception. For more information, visit our webpage at wmuk.org. For West Southwest on WMUK, I'm Earlene McMichael.